The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoon Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy. Welcome to Secure in Mind. Today's guest is Morgan Dean. Morgan and I have been communicating via LinkedIn, the fantastic tool that connects us all and, you know, potentially will sync us all, but let's hope it just connects. Morgan is the CEO of Baader Helvea Group. Now, the Baader Helvea Group is a bank, and we'll get into a lot more detail about just what type of bank it is. Morgan's background, he used to work in Bear Stearns, which was a bank which many people will remember had a couple of issues during a period of time back in 2008. And then he moved on into JP Morgan and then moved into Helvea Baader Bank Group. Also, the reason that he, as a CEO with the background in law and more on the, you know, the CEO side rather than the technology risk side or overall risk side, is that he is part of the Transparency Task Force. He's an ambassador for the Transparency Task Force. And that task force was established to address the lack of trust in the financial services industry. And that is a tough gig, considering the impact on the reputation of the financial services industry post-2008, post-X, post-Y. There are plenty of examples there. So I'm looking forward to this conversation where we're going to dive into, you know, Morgan's background, as we always do. We explore the human behind the policy and the position. And then we'll have a look at the efficacy of organizations and initiatives like the Transparency Task Force and a range of other interesting topics, including technology, blockchain, and an array of other mechanisms and tools that that we can talk about. So welcome to the conversation, Morgan.
Thank you very much, Nick. I'm very happy that you have me. Happy to be here.
Excellent. So we always do this. We skip back in time, depending on the guest, how far back. it is dependent on the guest. But why don't we go back to, I guess, when you sort of crystallized your career path and then some of the steps that you took, anything interesting that was happening during your time in investment banking and how you came to be where you are.
Well, I took a very meandering and long-winded way into banking and finance. I actually had never any intention of working in banking. It wasn't ever on my radar. I stumbled rather accidentally into it. My undergraduate degrees I have in law and in economic history. I wasn't really sure whether I wanted to become a lawyer, so I did a master's in economic history. Decided that wasn't for me. Then thought maybe I would be a human rights lawyer. So I did a master's in international human rights. And as part of my master's, I wrote my thesis on international law regarding child trafficking. And I spent 3 months in Ghana, in West Africa, to research that. So during that time, and it was a very, I mean, I look back at it now and it's like I'm talking about a different person. But it was the experience in Ghana didn't sort of crystallize a career path for me. I mean, I didn't make a decision at that point that I absolutely wanted to be a human rights lawyer. Mm. It did shape my thinking though, and it influenced how I approached the rest of my career. What I did, the big takeaway for me from that experience was that, you know, I went down to Ghana with the impression in my head of what child trafficking was about, the evil side of it, how bad it was, how badly it needed to be tackled. And when I got there and I was interviewing people who were, I suppose, for all intents and purposes, you know, traffickers and traffickees, what I realized was that there is a large part of these countries where what we consider to be child trafficking is actually a normal part of life, where parents, due to religious beliefs, have large families. They can't support them. They use people that they trust. Sometimes they're relatives, sometimes they're not. And those people will help bring those children down to the big cities, get them work. And they may never see their families again, but they're sending money back to their families. And it's a sort of a survival mechanism. And I kind of came away there thinking there's a difference here between what policy says should be happening and what's happening on the ground. And I think that I learned very quickly there that one size does not fit all. And sometimes there's, even if it's only 10%, there's something that needs to be thought about differently. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I've taken that that lesson with me throughout my career. And when I got into banking, I realized that you can stand in the middle of any given bank and you can find on one side, you've got creative business people with great ideas. And on the other side, you've got risk managers and compliance people and auditors who just don't get what you're trying to do on the business side.
Yep.
And somebody needs to help those two sides communicate. And again, policies and procedures don't always match what the end game should be. So that was something that I think I took away from that experience. I then was backpacking for 2.5 years to find myself, and then went in, including being down in your homeland.
Exactly. You found yourself in Australia.
Yeah, exactly. It's what happens to everybody.
Like every other Irish bloke.
Exactly. So then I came back to Dublin at the age of 28 and thought, I need to get a job. My friends have careers. I need to get started. And that's where I found myself at Bear Stearns. And knew nothing about banking, certainly knew nothing about derivatives. And
how did you get the job out of interest?
My cousin's best friend was the head of legal at Bear Stearns in Dublin. And Bear Stearns at that time, the only banking license they had outside of the US was actually the Irish entity. So their European headquarters were in London, but they had the banking entity in Ireland. So most of the really interesting business was being booked through Dublin. So there was actually a lot of people working there. It was a pretty important hub within the Bear Stearns network. And it was only through my cousin's friend that I got in. But once I got in, I made it my business to get up to speed pretty quickly. And I found the place fascinating. You know, it was an industry I knew nothing about. I loved being around really smart, creative people. I know Bear Stearns ran into its difficulties, but I still look back on that time as a very, from an intellectually challenging experience. It was really good.
Which area were you working in?
I was working in legal and compliance for all of the derivatives, for all of the fixed income derivatives business.
Okay.
And there were a lot of other sort of ancillary business lines booked in through the entity. So there was a distressed debt business, which was quite interesting, where, you know, distressed assets were being bought and broken up. Mm-hmm. It was such a new world for me. Loved every bit of it. And I wasn't afraid to ask questions. So I didn't care if I looked stupid by asking, how does this work? Why does this work? But what I realized was that by being one of the few people who were asking those questions, I found myself pretty soon being the person who seemed to know most about everything. Not everything about everything, but enough to be able to connect the dots. And it was that sort of mentality that got me. I moved up the ladder relatively quickly. When Bear Stearns then ran into trouble and was acquired by JP Morgan, I was taken over onto the JP Morgan side, where I got further experience at an institution like JP Morgan. Again, there's so much going on. But I didn't really want to. Sorry,
just quickly, with for some of the university student listeners who may not be familiar with the happenings of 12 years ago now, what happened with Bear Stearns? In summary,
Bear Stearns was one of the top banks when it came to creating the collateralized mortgage obligations and mortgage derivatives as a whole. So we were securitizing and packaging the mortgages that were being issued by banks around the US predominantly, but also in other locations.
Okay.
When 2008 came, now that we look back in sort of cold light of day, we can see that the mortgages that were being given out were being given out to people who really couldn't afford to have mortgages in the first place. And many of them were on a zero interest rate for the first couple of years. And then after 3 years, for example, they triggered off to be at whatever, 3%, 4%. And once that happened, people couldn't pay their mortgages. People defaulted on the mortgages. The packages of
security, and then the dominoes
became worth it. Then the dominoes fell. And we were left as one of the predominant securitization houses at that time. We ran into serious trouble. So we were acquired by JP Morgan, and JP Morgan took us over, kept parts of the business that made sense, and it was a scary time. I remember having a conversation with outside counsel at that time, and it was this exact time in 2008, because it was St. Patrick's weekend, and in Dublin the regulator was closed, most offices were closed, and we were working through the weekend because we were preparing to file for bankruptcy. And the outside counsel we dealt with had said, I've never had to file bankruptcy for a bank, so this is also new to me. Now we all know what the process is, but at that time it was a very new experience.
Okay, so then you jumped to JP Morgan. And after that, what kind of role were you playing in JP Morgan after the bankruptcy and the acquisition?
Still a legal and compliance role. The business units kind of expanded a little bit because a major part of JP Morgan's business in Ireland was fund servicing. So in mm-hmm. addition to the derivatives part, I was then taking on some of the responsibility on fund servicing. But in an institution like JP Morgan, I mean, it was a great place to work, but because it's so big, you do need to choose a specific niche and make that your own. And mm-hmm. I didn't really want to become an expert on one very specific thing. I liked the broadness of the role that I had had up to that point. And it was for that reason that I moved to Switzerland. The role came up at Helvea, which was the general counsel and chief compliance officer for mm. their international business. And it had a management angle to it because I would be a member of the management board. So that was kind of what caused me to move over to Switzerland. And then through a series of events, we were acquired by Baader Bank in Germany to make the business more significant and more powerful. And with that, I was part of the merger process. And in 2015, I took the CEO role for the international group. So now I'm responsible for all of the brokerage, the capital markets, the research businesses that are run internationally. We're five locations, and we have pretty much got we're touching clients in almost every continent now at this point.
Okay, does Baader Helvea have a niche that it's well renowned for?
Yeah, our sort of the deep area of expertise we have is what we call the DACH region, or the German, Austrian, Swiss region. So the German speaking economic region. We cover companies in that area that are listed on the exchanges. We have sort of very deep understanding of those companies. We issue research on them. We provide capital markets activities for those companies. And then outside of that, we trade globally. We also cover 600 companies on a European-wide basis for research. But our sweet spot that we're renowned for is that sort of German, that German-speaking region.
Okay. How's your German?
Not very good. I have a couple of months to fix that because my Swiss permit is up for renewal, and I have to get my language skills up to speed. So,
dear.
When I'm allowed back out after the coronavirus is gone, I'll be asking how to get to the bus station and trying to order food again. I can't even order food in Germany.
Yeah, you'll be brushing up. Well, yeah, I don't have that kind of constraint when I'm applying for my work permit over here in Italy, which is fortunate because my Italian grammar is just out the window. So anyway, on to better things. Okay, so we're all caught up. You're currently on the board and the CEO for Baader Helvea. There are a couple of points there which we'll get back to. And one is something that certainly, in my background, something that really informed my understanding of where policies can impact, where they don't, and also a deeper understanding of what they're trying to impact in terms of, you know, in developing countries, for example, and a greater appreciation of that from face-to-face, seeing what poverty does, seeing what decisions must be made by parents who do need to, you know, effectively sacrifice one of their kids to go work in the city to send money back to support the other four kids and the mum and the dad and the uncle and the auntie because they're not a nuclear family. It does, you know, working in 3 months or 6 months or years in that industry, you take that with you, don't you? You take that in. And it, yeah, I certainly think it informs. The reason that you and I started chatting, I reached out to you via LinkedIn, and of particular interest is the Transparency Task Force. And that's where we'll start, having set the stage of your background. And for the listeners, events like 2008 are easy to analyze in hindsight. There's a number of movies that have been made about the collapse in 2008. But part of the reason, from as I understand it, of the lack of trust that the public has and maintains but certainly post 2008 is as a result of some of the actions like the major players like Bear Stearns and other major players in the banking sector who were repackaging and maybe not analyzing as well as they could some of the bad debt. That's my simplistic version, and I'll leave it to you to expand on that. But let's cover it off point by point. Transparency Task Force, what is it? What are you doing in terms of, you know, constructing policy? And how do you foresee the effective implementation of some of these maybe suggestions, some of these policies in the industry? Do you have coordination with different stakeholders, including, say, government stakeholders and therefore policymakers, et cetera?
Right. Well, the Transparency Task Force was established. It's a voluntary organization. We have now 160 ambassadors in, I believe, we're in 21 countries. The idea behind it is to, first of all, identify what we call sort of the magic 1,000, of which are 1,000 people who are in senior policymaking positions, senior industry positions, senior government positions, people who have influence over the direction of where the financial services industry goes, so that we will have the right stakeholders who can implement the things that we talk about doing. And the second wave of what we do is we create what we call the financial development goals, which are principles that we feel are necessary in order to put the industry back on the right track. So we have things like, a client-centric culture, governing responsibly, a number of things like that. The one that attracts me the most is the one where we harness the power of technology. I think everybody who's in the task force has a particular affiliation with one or other of the principles that we have. And for me, I feel strongly about where technology is taking us. I feel strongly about where technology is going to take the financial services industry. And I think if we're talking about transparency and about trust, I think it has to come from technology. The Transparency Task Force was, when they first contacted me about getting involved, I mean, they drew my attention to a survey that I wasn't aware existed, but it was a survey in the UK which ranked and rated various professions and industries on the basis of trust as per how the consumers saw them. And traffic wardens and lawyers were rated more highly than bankers, which, as a lawyer, I can make this joke. If somebody says that you're at least less trustworthy than a lawyer, you've got to
say something's wrong.
yeah, exactly. And when I looked into it further, what I noticed was that the UK surveys were revealing that large financial institutions were simply distrusted to the point that nobody wanted to do business with them anymore. And a survey was done in Australia where Commonwealth Bank and the Commonwealth Bank was considered to be one of the least trustworthy, whereas banks like Bendigo and Suncorp were considered more trustworthy because they were smaller. But the thing that amazed me the most was a reputation survey was done in the US, and banks were asked, what are the three things that you think are most important for building trust? And the bank said, well, we believe it is to protect the consumer's money, to make the money available when they need it, and to protect them from data breaches. And then the consumers were asked, what are the things that you consider the most important when you choose a trustworthy bank? And they said, well, we look at how they treat their people in terms of equal pay based on race and gender. We look at their social responsibility, and we look at whether or not they treat their customers well, if they care about us. Are there management, is management involved in any sort of scandal or any sort of misbehavior? And it amazed me because I thought, here we go again. This is like what I saw when I was in Ghana. We have got people solving a problem on one side, and the people on the other side have a totally different problem that isn't being solved. So somebody needs to bring this together. And I felt this is a good initiative to get involved in, because if we need to fix the trust in the financial services industry, we need to approach it the right way.
Okay, so you've got 1,000 stakeholders who are high level, holding high level positions in relevant industries, so financial industry, but also in Swiss government as well.
In Switzerland, we're a little bit further behind. In the UK is where the task force started. UK and Australia is where we've got probably more of the higher level people. But it's an ongoing process, and we're certainly creating awareness day by day.
Okay, and so the Transparency Task Force it's not just Swiss based. This is a global initiative. How much collaboration is there amongst international banks? You mentioned Commonwealth Bank. For the listeners who are predominantly European listeners, CBA is the largest, I think, largest of the big four retail banks in Australia. Do you have regular communication with all the players globally in the US and in Australia as well about what's working, what's not?
Well, at the moment, we're welcoming in anybody from any of the banks who want to participate. What the intention would be that when it comes to interacting with the likes of the big four in Australia or in any other country, it would be that we would have set policies first. And I think we're probably not yet at the stage where the largest banks will take us that seriously, but we're getting there. And I think we will get there by, first of all, lobbying and working with the stakeholders on the policy side. Because I think one of the big frustrations in finance is that I don't think there's any bank who objects to regulation in principle. What I think people object to is regulation that doesn't make sense. And here we have a classic situation. Since 2008, in fact, since 2001, we've been getting buried deeper and deeper every year in regulation on the banking side. And it's hugely frustrating to think that we've spent all this money and all this time complying with regulations that are supposed to protect the consumer. But when you ask the consumer if they feel safe, they say, no, we still don't trust the banks. Mm. There's something wrong. And I think it also there's a little bit of give and take, but I think sensible policy and sensible regulation is something that needs to be explored. So that's where we're going.
Yeah, and that's it's tough as well, because there are different areas of the bank and there are different mechanisms and even people who are employed by the bank to execute certain things. So in Commonwealth Bank, some of the scandals came about in there was a Royal Commission, there were some scandals that were looking at the what was one of the big ones? I think wealth management was one of the big ones, where they were pushing products. Well, they had very aggressive sales targets, and the types of people that they're recruiting into those positions are going to be the aggressive sales types who want to close a deal at any cost. And I think that was part of the reason in the wealth management portfolio. But I'll have to look that up. So there's one aspect of banking which is always going to be an aggressive. Push it to the envelope type of mentality that's driving it, and that inevitably is going to be harnessed by regulation, but it needs to be, as you said, correctly applied regulation. But then there's the other part of the bank which doesn't have that aspect and doesn't have that soured reputation. And it's, if you're talking about a company that employs 200,000 people, then you're going to get good, bad and ugly, regardless of how much regulation you throw at it. Similar to a government, there's always aspects that you can criticize of a government, even if overall it functions pretty damn well, I guess.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things which, when I look at the banking industry now, I mean, I'm working in it since 2004. When I look back on that time and I see the problems that we face right now, I think a lot of them are linked to size. We have huge organizations and even the sort of mid-sized organizations from a staff perspective are very, very big. And there has been an explosion in the amount of those people who are working in control and compliance and audit functions. So a lot of money has been spent on that. But they sometimes operate independently within the organization. So they're a bit too disconnected from the business. So you can have people who are very aggressive on the business side and people who are probably too far disconnected from the business who work on the control side. So you have these weird situations where sometimes I look at institutions and I think it's almost like the people working there think that they're a compliance business with a banking business on the side, when in fact the compliance function should be supporting the business. And it's not the fault of compliance either. It's the fact that the big fear is that you're going to breach a rule or a regulation, and even if that regulation doesn't make sense, you're sort of handcuffed to it. So in the end, you're ticking boxes, you're checking that when a customer gets their account statement that it has 10 pages of a disclaimer. Nobody's going to read that, but it ticks the box.
Yeah, and that's ticking the boxes, to switch gears into another industry which is much more in my wheelhouse, cybersecurity. Ticking boxes for compliance doesn't do shit to stop the bad guys. And to actually enforce proper and effective regulation, ticking boxes is one thing, but it's not the overall necessity. With the Transparency Task Force, how far away are you from actually executing and adopting some of the policies that you're driving and developing, and then be potentially interacting with government and policymakers on the government side to adopt them into formal federal policy? Is that an avenue that you're looking to head? Is that the direction?
Those conversations have begun, certainly in the UK, a little less so in Australia, but the UK is where most of the organization has started there. There's a lot more senior government stakeholders based in the UK. So there have been discussions with pension boards at government level, and there's a lot of progress being made. I'm not sure if this is going to be a big bang. I sort of feel that, like, we've got several different development goals, and I feel that if we make a little bit of progress in all of them, it might sort of insidiously happen that we influence the way things are. I mean, the ideal world would be that you'd lead to some great policy change and that there would be best practices issued and people would comply with them. My fear is that you also don't want to focus too much on policy, because if you create great policies, they become things that people put on the wall and read out loud, but don't actually practice. And I think it's more important to be practicing something good than to have a list of great policies. And from my point of view, I'm involved in this because I'm keen to get people from the technology and particularly fintech side to come in to help them understand what the problems were in 2008, to help them to understand the problems banks face now, And because they're fintech firms with a blank canvas, they can create something that really works. And maybe trust is going to be rebuilt in financial services by the small players, by the new disruptors. They're the ones that will bring it forward. Not, it won't be because the big banks change, because I fear that the public will always see anything that the big banks do as nothing more than a makeup exercise, whereas fintech firms might get further.
And trust is a great word. It's being thrown around a lot in Switzerland at the moment in a slightly different area, but I don't know whether you've seen the Crypto AG debacle, a company that's selling machines to embassies and foreign governments, which were sold by a Swiss firm called Crypto AG. The Swiss marketing team obviously promoting the neutrality of the machine, but the real ownership, it was actually from the American CIA and the BND in Germany. And they were purposely tampering with the sophistication of the encryption algorithm so that they could actually break this technology, which was then put into different countries, embassies all around the world, including allied countries. So when that's a bit off topic from the banking discussion, but it's the same principle. When you have something like trust, which I guess initially was established as a result of the famed neutrality of a country like Switzerland, for example, which is then is very, very damaged as a result of happenings which have been happening for more than 30 years. How do you fix that? That's a really tough call. And ironically, even though this was the technology that was the avenue to breaking the trust, so too, the answer very likely lies within technology as well in order to establish the trust. So then the question becomes, what kind of technology can you actually establish which has that almost certainty? And there's some, and this is obviously leading to the next discussion, which is, what are you seeing in fintech that potentially has the necessary tools, the necessary structure to be implemented into whatever area of banking and can offer that kind of trust?
Well, I'm a big believer in blockchain. I find it very hard to see a future that isn't built on it. If we take it sort of step by step, I mean, what I'm seeing in finance now, we're seeing a lot of disruptive fintech companies coming to the market with some really great ideas. And I feel that they are the first step to rebuilding trust, because it's easier to trust a smaller company that does something simple. If we look at the financial industry, the way it has developed, there are big banks that do everything. They're all things to all people. Whereas the fintechs are focusing on very, very specific problems. You know, we've got micro lenders who are not interested in dealing with everybody. They just want to deal with a small business owner who needs somewhere between 5,000 and 30,000 pounds. They can approve your loan in 30 minutes using your social media scores. Like that's very, very good for somebody who wants exactly that.
Yeah.
You see banks like Revolut coming in with products which are very, very tailored, very specific. They're making major headway. Mm. So I think these disruptive fintechs are the first wave of rebuilding trust, because they're focusing on specific problems. They're not trying to answer everything. They're just saying, well, you don't like high fees, we're going to fix that for you. You don't like that it takes 3 weeks to get approved for a loan, we're going to fix that for you in 30 minutes. So I think that's the first wave. I also like what I see happening in terms of tokenization. So the sort of crypto and blockchain developments that are allowing companies to raise funds using tokenization. Because what that is doing is that it's where previously entrepreneurs and founders were having to follow the money, and you were seeing clusters of startups in Silicon Valley and New York and London, and you know, they were following the major financial centers. Now, if you're a really smart startup founder, but you happen to be in Addis Ababa, you can also raise money through tokenization, which means you don't necessarily need to be based near these financial centers. And you may have an idea which is really, really good, where you would never have got that off the ground previously. So the impact is being felt already. And I think the more startups we get in there that disrupt the financial industry, the better. I don't feel scared by it. People say, but you're a CEO of a bank, are you not scared? Not at all. I think there's room for everyone. And I think the industry, anything that benefits the industry will benefit all of the participants. And maybe it means we need to reinvent ourselves a little bit, but I don't think that's a terribly bad thing either.
No, it's the ICO situation is an interesting one, because yes, it does afford the bloke in Addis Ababa to access funds which he otherwise would not have had access to. The concern with the ICO market, at least, was that there were a bunch of fluff pieces and vapor. That, I guess, what are your thoughts on that? Because there haven't been, as far as I'm aware, regulations in the ICO market, because it's so new. So what are the kind of warning signs or policies that can be implemented in order to save potential investors from losing their cash on vaporware? Do they exist? Are they getting implemented? Is that a reason why the more established institutional type of way avenues of raising funds are still better considered simply because they do have these regulations around, you know, fraudulent investment opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, the ICO market has gotten a pretty bad reputation. I think it's fair to say that the ICOs as we used to know them in 2016 and 17 are dead. And unfortunately, it's because the bad eggs ruined the basket for everybody else. There were some good companies in there, but they got sort of tarred with the same brush. Things have changed. Regulation is certainly moving faster than it was back in 2016. Most of the major regulators worldwide are at least coming out with statements on whether or not these offerings are securities or not. They're classifying them a little bit better. In Switzerland, FINMA have issued guidance on tokenized offerings. The understanding of what tokenization means is definitely improved.
Yeah.
I think for example, in Germany, we've had a number of decentralized offerings of property portfolios. There was a company last year called Fundament, which issued tokens completely on a decentralized basis, but it was approved by BaFin. So we were able to you're getting regulatory approval behind these. So I think from an outside investor, and I wouldn't be the one to say to anyone, I mean, this is still high risk. I wouldn't recommend people to be dabbling in it for the fun.
Yeah.
But there's certainly more clarity coming on what's good and what's not. Mm. And I think you'll find I know that the Swiss Exchange are working on a digital platform, which when this kind of thing starts to happen, you'll find that there are more sort of regulated, transparent platforms on which companies can raise money, still decentralized, but with a lot more certainty and assurance.
Yeah,
so we're getting there. It's not a big bang. It's a slow process to get there, but we're on that road.
Okay, so with your view, with your vantage point as a CEO in a bank and looking externally into the fintech scene, how are you seeing this unfolding in terms of, you know, larger institutions adopting some of these things in house, and how is that happening? Do you see some of the larger companies, you mentioned the stock exchange, setting up their own innovation centers? How are you seeing this over the market? Who do you think is got the best strategy in place?
It's an interesting one. I mean, in the first instance, it's a lot harder for banks to attract the kind of talent into their doors than it maybe was 10, 15 years ago. So the smartest tech people who are building this kind of thing don't necessarily want to work in a bank. They're going to the tech firm. So if you want to attract that kind of talent, it's very difficult. And what we're seeing more of is that the bigger banks are acquiring or investing in startups and allowing the startups to sort of work on their own on the side. Mm-hmm. I've had funny conversations with people who work in banks in other countries where they've set up innovation hubs internally, and they've pretty much said to these guys, look, go build something, tell us about it and
have fun.
It to us. Yeah. Have fun. And then they come into the room with their idea, and they're met with a team of auditors and control people
who aren't fun.
They give them the 19 reasons why this won't work. And it's almost like innovation goes to die in these places.
Yeah.
So I think what the only way forward is you get a stake in a startup, you let them run with it themselves, you give them the entrepreneurial freedom, because in that environment, things will grow. It's very hard within the big institutions for this kind of thing to happen.
Yeah. Do you have any examples of ones where ones that buck that trend? Any large institutions who have established an effective running innovation center? Because off the top of my head, knowing Australian and Asia Pacific market, I can't think of many.
I can't think of any off the top of my head, but that doesn't mean it's not happening, because we're still at a very early stage, and I know a lot of the Swiss banks are doing a lot of work behind their doors on blockchain and cryptocurrency platforms. So it's definitely happening, but I guess it hasn't come to fruition in a way that you look back and say, well, they did a great job and they did it themselves. I think we're not there yet, so it may very well happen.
Yeah. Where do you see this all leading in the next 2 to 5 years? Banking as a general sector, what's happening?
Well, it's very hard. It's very hard to predict, especially where technology goes. I mean, I wonder if you asked somebody in 1995 to predict where the internet was going to take us, they certainly wouldn't have said anything about Instagram and Twitter. But that's the world they're in now. if you said to me, like, let's say you told me you had a crystal ball there, and you said, look, I'm looking at a player. It's the most significant player in the financial industry, and they're brand new. What do you think? My answer would be, well, I think they're definitely working on blockchain. They've definitely done something significant on blockchain. And in my view, they may be the ones that have cracked the problem of providing services to the unbanked. I think it's the biggest commercial opportunity that exists in finance is to bring financial services to whatever it is, 1.7 billion people who have no access to financial services at all. You bring that to them, it's a massive commercial opportunity, but it's also probably the most socially responsible thing we can do in finance when it comes to development. If you can bring services to those people and create a platform that works for them, then you will become the most significant player in finance as a whole, because that platform will work for the rest of us as well. So if somebody is like, I do feel we're going, I don't know in 5 years if that problem is going to be answered, but I do think that it'll be blockchain platforms going forward. And whether or not they're owned by banks, whether they're completely decentralized,
or both,
I don't know, or both. But that's where finance is going. And I think the way that we make payments and we transfer money is changing. There'll be other elements that, you know, will probably still remain the same. You still need somebody to sit you down and talk about what your best investment options are. And when it comes to a pension, you still need people to explain that to you.
Yeah.
And you still need to understand what are the best companies to invest in. So there'll be still elements of that. But the payments industry, how you swipe your card and the stuff that goes on behind your card before the payment gets made, those kind of things, they need to be fixed and they will be fixed.
Yeah. Bringing the discussion back to risk, the Transparency Task Force, this is kind of a mixing question of Transparency Task Force and also Switzerland as a nation, and the general concept of trust. The banking sector came under fire a number of times, and part of the reason, I guess, traditionally was the unwillingness to open up for say international investigations. That's changed also from a cultural and regulatory perspective. Do you see the industry is tackling this properly? And also, yesterday we spoke, and I think it was either myself or you who came up with the example of Facebook on a related but a different matter, where they received a $5 billion slap on the wrist, which they can wipe off their books in, you know, weeks. And the model of Facebook hasn't changed as a result of that fine, simply because it doesn't impact, that doesn't force them to sit down at the table and say, right, guys, we just lost 80% of our revenue for a year. We seriously got to do stuff. It was just a tiny little speed bump. So I guess the question comes back down to the efforts that organizations like the Transparency Task Force are making. That's one. The nation, how it works with international players and investigations, and how it's improved its regulatory stance and interacts with the international communities is second, and where you see that leading as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was a massive upheaval for Switzerland when it happened, and I mean, at the time I thought that the private banking industry in Switzerland would struggle to recover.
Yeah,
it hasn't worked out like that. I think Switzerland had created a brand which was far greater than secrecy, private banking services here. It was always about security. It was about safety. Switzerland is still a safe place to have your money.
Yeah.
So I think the private banks reinvented themselves. I think what was difficult for Switzerland to take was the sort of implicit remark that they had to change what they were doing because they were facilitating crime. I think it's a little bit unfair.
Yeah.
You know, privacy has always been valued here in Switzerland, and not just Switzerland. I mean, Germany values privacy very highly. Mm. And I think the sort of suggestion that Switzerland was using privacy as a shield to cover up criminal activity was just inaccurate. There were examples, and I know we've seen them in the news, and there have been fines, but that doesn't represent all of the private banking industry.
And it represents the global marketplace, because it represents England, it represents the United States, and that's the issue. And I guess that it does sit with my point, because regardless of what the truth is, that branding of trust is impacted from these specific examples, and then you have to recover from that, regardless of whether 10% of it is absolutely true, but the other 90% is just it's conflated.
And I will say, I mean, since I've been in Switzerland, I've been here since 2010, and I've been, you know, working on I started working in the legal and regulatory side. So I know exactly what the money laundering guidance has been here. I know the standard that FINMA has set. It's at a par, sometimes even better than other countries. Sometimes it feels like it might even be a more sensible approach. So I don't think there was ever an issue that anti-money laundering rules were ineffective here in Switzerland. I think we've got a problem with the fact that anti-money laundering has somehow found itself sitting in a place at the table, which is supposedly more important than data privacy. And that worries me, because I think we need to take privacy a lot more seriously than we do, especially in a world where everything we're doing is electronic. We have to find a way that we protect our privacy. I don't think that, you know, Nick Kelly giving his utility bill that it's 3 months old instead of 4 months old is going to create more controls around financial crime. But that's the nonsense that goes on. You know, we have you open an account at a bank, and the processes you have to go through for Know Your Customer are sometimes so ineffective, and you know that you're not really contributing to the combating of financial crime and drug trafficking or whatever else you're supposed to be combating. So I think we need to use technology to go forward on that.
And talking about privacy, this skips right back to the Facebook example about privacy. I mean, the slap on the wrist was for the Cambridge Analytica scandal. Did that change it? No, of course not. Their business model is about extracting as much information as possible to sell targeted ads. You know, Facebook as a technology company, their motivation isn't evil per se. It is to sell you as much stuff as possible by personalizing as much stuff as possible. But the use of that as a mechanism is so dangerous, to the point where you can sway elections. And that's, now we're talking about, you know, changing democracies and governments and putting people in power who you may or may not disagree with. And, you know, it does come back to the question, what is an appropriate fine? What is an appropriate regulatory constraint that you can make that actually makes it, puts the brakes on rather than puts a sort of speed bump in the way? And it's not just about banking. That's in many areas, especially in tech, because, you know, nowadays Facebook, with half the world is on Facebook, billions and billions of people, and with the potential power it had for manipulation of those, it's simple from a physiological perspective to inject dopamine and then make, you know, that's the way it works, right? Why doesn't it have the same constraints as other critical infrastructure, like power plants, like grids, like financial services? Well, it doesn't, and it has to take time, because they've had years to form. Technology doesn't wait; it evolves rapidly. So, yeah, it's interesting, and I think technology is the answer, and also it's the curse as well. And it's going to be that dichotomy, and managing that dichotomy is the pain for CEOs to shoulder.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the case of Facebook, I suppose they're a victim as well of what they've created. I mean, we talk about financial services, you talk about power plants. That is the provision of a utility or a product to people, and you can govern and control how you sell that to people. The issue that Facebook faces is not only the fact that they have a certain duty of care towards the data that they hold, but they're falling victim of the fact that they're providing a platform, and it's very hard to predict how people will use the platform. We don't have that problem in finance. We provide a product, and it's either suitable or it's not. So Facebook does have a sort of a fluid thing that, you know, they set up, and they provided a platform which I think everybody loved using, and it was innocent in its beginnings. But how it has evolved and how people have used it means that, unfortunately for Facebook, the product they created hasn't changed massively, neither has their business model, but the world around the product has, and that's something they need to move with.
Absolutely, and then that changes from platform to media facilitator, or it does change the actual emphasis of the business itself, regardless of whether that was the intention. Really, well, great discussion. Were there any other points that you wanted to explore? You know, what you guys are doing now in Barter, it's keeping an eye out for external players and seeing whether they're, you know, external fintech players and investing in those ones that show promise. And, you know, what does your day-to-day look like these days?
We don't deal with retail banking. I mean, our business is entirely institutional, so we're, you know, we're watching carefully where things are going on our side. This is my personal feeling. I believe strongly that blockchain is coming, and it's coming fast, and I think it's going to be a revolutionary but a very positive change for the industry. How we position ourselves in that is something we're watching carefully all of the time. We won't be changing what our core is. You know, our core is still about providing the research, providing the capital markets services in our what we're good at, but how we provide it might be influenced by blockchain or tokenization. So we're watching that. On a personal level, I mean, I continue to be involved privately in mentoring startups. What I'm finding more and more is on the fintech side that there are some really great ideas and some really great founders, But they end up finding themselves navigating a world which is a lot more dusty and a lot more complicated than they're used to dealing with. You know, you come up with a great idea in fintech, you still have to deal with the same regulator that has been regulating the industry for 20 or 30 years. So sometimes there's a bridge needed between those two worlds, and I do what I can to help them. Because I think as a financial services industry, we need to be supportive of each other. Not everybody is competition who's going to eat your lunch. I think you have to be that way. So I do that in a private way, and I'm, you know, sometimes I speak at events where we're at a very interesting point in time now, where we have very, very different thinking types of people in generations that are coming behind us. I mean, you know, people joke about millennials, but they do think differently, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. And Generation Z is even more different again, and there's a lot more focus on things that we all should have been focusing on the environment, on social responsibility. So I think the people who've been in the industry for 30 years can learn a lot from the people who are, you know, 20 years old, and vice versa. And I think somebody just needs to make sure that communication is happening and that it isn't getting lost. And I think if we harness that kind of power, you match people's social values with technology, with experience from what's happened in the past. And I think we have a very, very bright future, not just in finance, but across the board. I think there's some really interesting times ahead.
It does remind me of a point that we were talking about yesterday about the attraction of talent, and how it is a bit tough still for some of the larger financial institutions to compete with, you know, the mecca of creativity like Google is. You know, for all the good and the bad that Google has, its headquarters in Zurich, kind of, it's like a black hole for the top of the top talent. It's not to say, you know, the people on the level down aren't absolutely brilliant, but it's tough, you know, and you got to compete with the salaries that Google, you know, shoves as well. And I guess a constant issue, but that probably that's about positioning and pitching yourself as a, you know, as a forward-thinking technology-focused bank and an industry as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, the days of throwing more money at people, that doesn't necessarily work anymore. People are looking for something where they feel a part of a vision. They see that they're going to make a difference in the future. So it's not enough to just say, look, we'll pay you twice what Google will pay you just to come here and fix our systems. I mean, you need to be showing them that they're joining an organization which is forward thinking, like you say, but where they can go and talk to their friends and be proud that they work there. There's that kind of value. Maybe that didn't exist 30 years ago. You just went, you were happy to get a job, and maybe it's because we've had decades of prosperity and peace that now when people come into the workforce, they want to make a difference. They want to have some sort of social vision. But that's what exists, and it's not a bad thing, but you just need to prepare yourself as a company, and management needs to be aware of that.
All right. Well, look, I've enjoyed this conversation a lot, and I hope you have too. Where can people in the audience find you? Speaking events, hackathons, or anything that you're involved in your spare time?
Well, I'm mostly active on probably LinkedIn is the best place to find where if I'm speaking at events, I would post it there. I'm, you know, I attend events here in Zurich. If anyone happens to see me or know that I'm there, please feel free to come along and say hello.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I'll put a link to your LinkedIn in the show notes if that's okay with you. Yeah. And thank you very much for joining me on this remote podcast. I look forward to actually meeting in person once the corona craziness has lifted the borders.
Yes. Who knows when that will be?
You know, well, we'll wait and see. So look, take care. Great to speak. And we will catch up very soon.
Right. Thanks, Nick. All the best.
Cheers.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoom Technology Consulting, global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.